I'm Frederick Gerton, and I'm the filmmaker.
And I'm Leilani Farha, and I'm the advocate.
Do you know how many times we've said that now? I mean, a lot of podcasts say this is episode number something.
Right. Well, season six, episode, I don't know, six?
I think it's actually episode 88.
Overall. Is it really? Yeah. You counted.
And of course I might have missed something because I'm not a mathematician.
88. That's the age of my father.
Yeah. You see? Mine is 93, so let's see how we get there.
Let's see
there.
If we can get there.
And I just checked, we have now listeners in 156 countries.
Oh, we're getting close to world domination.
Yes, and the last download was then in Sint Maarten, former Dutch colony.
Yes, of course.
In the Caribbean. So it's nice. You're all welcome. We are travelers, we like when there is new countries coming in because we want to go there and
Absolutely.
Meet you all.
Absolutely.
And just sit down and talk about important stuff.
Exactly.
And maybe also have a glass of wine. But Leilani, first of all, I have to say thank you very much for knocking my door, my office door, the day of my world premiere. You know, I'm here in Malmo, Sweden. The world premiere were at CPH Docs in Copenhagen. And I was here at my office getting, ready, but still working. And you just knocked the door.
Surprise.
By surprise. That was a bit weird, wasn't it?
It was fantastic. I was planning and plotting with your colleague, Margaret, and just trying to figure out, should I surprise you for the world premiere or let you know? Should I surprise you? There were benefits and drawbacks no matter which way I went. And I thought, it's special to surprise someone, especially because I live so far away.
You do.
So, it was fantastic.
I was really, really happy that you came. And it was cool to share that moment with you. And then after the premiere, we were sitting out in some really junk food place after midnight, eating some horrible food with Irish from Toronto. It was really nice. So it's friendship. And we haven't met for 3 years, but still we have been doing all these 87 episodes of this podcast.
Yes. Well, I surprised you almost exactly 3 years to the day since we last saw each other, which seemed special too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And since then, I had my screenings in Copenhagen at the CPH Docs. And then I've been to Prague, where the last place we were showing Push, we went Breaking Social to the One World Film Festival in Prague, which is an amazing place. And then I've been to Brussels for a special screening.
Yes, that looked fantastic.
So
Frederick, we should say... Frederick's new film is called Breaking Social, and it is doing the festival circuit at the moment with very special audiences, and it's an amazing film, and all of our listeners should figure out how to go see it somewhere, sometime.
Yeah. Right now, at this moment, we have a crowdfunding campaign going on, and the idea is to fund the impact campaign around the film, because we believe that films like Push and Breaking Social can feed into conversations that we have around. And hopefully, I mean, I got some very good responses from audiences in different countries here, that it also, people get some hope out of the film, which is kind of cool.
It is cool. Yeah. And as someone who was part of a Kickstarter campaign for Push, it's really an important moment in a film's life, I think, or at least in your film's life, because it's a way for community, individuals, groups to get engaged in an issue and be part of something bigger. And of course, it's really important to get films out there because I can say, more than many other people, I can say films make a huge difference in making change. when I look at financialization of housing and where we are at now, I can say with confidence that the movement I've seen in the last years, the progress, the way everyone just talks about financialization of housing, housing as a human right, as if it's like normal, that's in large part because of Push the Film circulating around. Here's a story for you. I went out for dinner with some friends. I haven't had a dinner with them in a long time, just this past weekend. And as I was leaving, the guy who took my coat said to me, I saw you in a film a couple of weeks ago. I said, oh, Push the Film. He said, yes, I saw it on TVO. And, you know, you're a rock star. Keep going. And I'm with you. And you're doing important work. And this is the issue, et cetera, et cetera. So pretty cool.
Cool. Let's hope that
films change the world.
Let's hope Breaking Social can inspire people to change the world also. That's my ambition.
I think it can.
In the film, we meet a lot of different very cool people, and one of the characters of the film is a journalist from Malta, Matthew Caruana Galizia. He's a Pulitzer winner. He worked on Panama Papers, and he's now continuing the work of his mother, Daphne yes. Caruana Galizia, who was assassinated in a car bomb 5 years ago. So I had a call with him, and you were not out, Leilani. So we decided to record it, and you should listen to it. It's an interesting talk about corruption and journalism as resistance. So because these journalists are doing an amazing job to reveal how the super rich are running the planet, because they through the all these leaks, they actually helps us to make this, to understand the pattern of it all.
Mm.
Very inspiring. So
I'm going to listen to the episode that I missed. And Matthew, of course, is so close to the corruption and seeing it up close, both as a journalist, but also because of the personal relationship, obviously, with his mother. Mm. And in the film Breaking Social, I admit I wanted a little more of him. So I'll get a little more of him through Pushback Talks.
Yeah. So first of all, I played him the trailer.
We live in a society where we're continuously being told, if you follow the rules, if you do well in school, then you'll be fine. And it's basically a lie.
Kleptocracy exists on an international scale. We're living through a period where coalitions of these super rich, of these money maximizers, gain control over the bulk of the political and economic life.
Global rich are choosing who's in and out of power. The mechanism exists to do that.
And you have to be really smart to do it. You know, it's difficult work. It's hard work. You need to go to Harvard or Princeton or whatever, but you don't contribute anything. You know, you just learn how to steal from others.
If you're not angry, then you're just not paying attention.
I'm pretty sure they continue to fight me forever, but you know, I can tell you on our end the same thing.
The moment people are becoming angry, that's the moment things are actually already improving.
So that was the trailer. And I guess it's a little bit unfair because most of you haven't seen the film. But we sent a link to Matthew. And Matthew is an award-winning journalist based on Malta. Been into this for a long time. You were already early on working with the Panama Papers, what I understand. And then you were suddenly, this got extremely close to you when your mother, Daphne Caruana Galizia, got assassinated more than 5 years ago in October 2017. And you see that Malta is in this film, Matthew. There are images already here in the trailer. What does come through your mind when you see this, the trailer?
I mean, most of the time, things feel very fresh in my memory. But of course, when I see the images of the site where my mom's car ended up and of the protests in Malta, it makes it even closer still.
Yeah. So, I mean, at the pattern of corruption, you can tell it from many places around the planet. I wanted to do it in Malta because I mean, there is a link. I think I told you when we were filming with you that when I was long time ago, 11, 12 years ago, when I did a film called Bananas, and I got slapped and sued by the biggest fruit company on the planet, the Dole Food Company. And I felt really isolated. And it's hard to be a journalist under attack, because when they attack you, they don't only attack what you do, it's also you personally, because they try to get at you and they try to isolate you. So I decided from then on that I would try to be the one who also looks out for other journalists under pressure. So that's why in some way I got to see your mom's work really early on and to follow. So it's been a story that's been in some way close to me, even if what's happened in your family is 100 times worse than ever happened to me. But Malta is interesting because it has also this kind of microcosm of corruption. Is that a word? Can you put it like that?
I mean, I was just commenting to someone I know who lives outside Malta that even if you're not Maltese and you never lived here, it's quite easy to follow what's happening in the country, because there's just so much going wrong in such a small place. But it always involves the same quite small group of people. And the same tiny elite who have a hold over our country's economy and government, really. So it makes it quite easy to follow. I hate using the words like drama or anything like that, because what continues to happen here is very real. And it's not a work of fiction. It's not something to sort of sit back and enjoy for someone far away. But it is quite easy to follow in the same way that a series is, let's say, except that we're not here for sort of anyone's entertainment.
No, you're not. And I also, when I decided to film with Joanna, you and Caroline Muscat, is that for me, you were also a group of resistance. You've been really damaged by this violence and with this corruption, but you're also fighting back. And for me, you're also an inspiration, your group of journalists that are keep going. And I think in this film, the ambition for me is to don't really have victims on the film, you know, because I mean, all the people in the film are beautiful people who are in some way are fighting back. That's so, but I'm interested in, I mean, and sometimes now I give interviews and I talk to a lot of journalists about my film and my work. And I try to say that I admire the work of Panama Papers and all the group that are bringing out all these big leaks. Mm-hmm. And you've been working on that too. But sometimes when it lands into the national newspapers in a country like Sweden, it becomes more some sketchy individuals that had been running away, they're not paying their taxes or hiding money. It becomes like juicy small stories. And what I think the ambition with my film is that we should more talk about the pattern out there, the pattern of corruption and kleptocracy, so we have a chance to change it and to regulate it. Have you felt that also, like sometimes a frustration of the outcome of these leaks, that it's sometimes the publicity lands a little bit in the corners?
I mean, when I was working on the leaks, like, my life is divided in two. I mean, before my mother's murder and after it. And when I was working on the leaks at ICIJ, I mean, I thought of my job as a job, right? I didn't think that I was on some kind of crusade or anything like that. And no one in my entire team did either. None of us did. We never sort of patted ourselves on the backs and say, here we go, you know, another day defeating the global elite. We never said anything like that or thought anything like that or wrote anything like that. We, at least I, thought that there were a group of people who felt that they were cleverer than everyone else and that they could get away from the duties that everyone else had to society, you know, that because they were so clever, they could get away with not paying taxes, with laundering money, with profiting from crime and so on. But we thought of ourselves as a group of people who were perhaps a little bit smarter, who had learned how to sort of unravel their tricks and expose what they were doing, basically. Of course, after my mother's murder, I realized that, you know, the implications of what these criminals and their enablers were doing could impact my life much more directly.
Yeah, and it's and so it did. And it's not only in your family, also we know journalists in Slovakia were also killed, and there is a constant threat against journalists who are going up against these circles.
Statistically, the number one cause of murders of journalists is corruption.
Yeah,
it's not reporting from war zones. It's corruption.
Yeah, I mean, as the native peoples of all countries are the ones who live close to the resources where the extraction is happening. They are the ones they kill first, and then the environmental activists and the journalists coming in after. So it's, you see that a lot all over the planet, and it's quite underreported in some strange way. Because, I mean, the extraction of wealth is still something that is, people don't like when you stand between them and their money, basically.
Of course not. I mean, but what is potentially worse than that is the ambivalence of the rest of society to corruption, the feeling of hopelessness, of exhaustion. These are things that create a sense of defeat and compliance. And that is the worst possible thing that can happen to your country or to the world, really.
Yeah. And I mean, in the film, I bring in the amazing Sarah Chase, who talks about the pattern of kleptocracy. And so we try to some way understand this from a global scale. And the ambition with the film is that you basically, that wherever you live around the planet, you should watch the film and you can sit down and say, okay, how does it look in my country, in my town? Because it's sometimes you say, oh, yeah, Malta, that's a corrupt place. Ha ha ha. You know, I mean, there is this kind of way of explaining things by, oh, the Maltese have always been corrupt. I mean, even on Malta, you can hear that kind of storytelling.
Yeah, but I don't like that.
No,
I don't like that rhetoric at all, because you condemn an entire country, an entire people, to that fate. And I find it really upsetting, disappointing, when I hear officials or diplomats using that kind of language.
Yeah, you should be.
I mean, some time ago I was in Beirut, and I mean, sitting at table with a diplomat, I mean, representing the European Union in Lebanon. And that was exactly his attitude. You know, it's Lebanon. It's always going to be like this. There's nothing we can do. There's no point in trying to fight corruption here. I find that kind of attitude to be extremely disappointing. I mean, I reject it completely. When I hear someone using it, then I push back against it.
I think all of us should reject that, because it's a very easy way out for people who want to explain things. I mean, I think we should talk about the forces that are also creating corruption and how they are connected. And in the film, there we also touched down. We'll just play a little clip from the film with you, just so we can hear your voice from the film with some sense.
No people are born corrupt, except people who have some kind of psychopathic disorder. When you lie the first time, when you lie the second time, third time, what this does to you is that it debases you. You get used to it. It becomes a way of being. This is what this has done to the people who are supposed to be the watchdogs. Lawyers, accountants, the regulators, these are the people who are supposed to be raising the alarm. Instead, they have been taught to participate in this fraud. And for them, it has become normality.
The regulators are suddenly on the other side, which is, of course, very sad in a country.
Of course. I mean, this became possible in Malta because the executive of branch of government controls practically everything that goes on here. I mean, the prime minister is like an elected monarch who appoints every person to every board, every committee. Very little happens in the country without him approving of it.
So that also means that you and your group of friends and journalists are still like in a little bit an isolated corner of the island, or do you feel that you have a bigger support now than before?
I mean, we always had a lot of support. When my mother was sued by the Minister of the Economy, for example, and as a part of that lawsuit, he froze her bank accounts. Within 48 hours, around 50,000-60,000 euros had been raised for my mother's legal defense. And this in a country as small as Malta. I mean, people were catching buses to go into Valletta to hand over 5 euros in an envelope. Hmm. So there was always quite a lot of public support. And I think part of it is because obviously my mother and her fight were inspiring to people, and they felt they needed that figure, that kind of superhero, to give them some hope.
Yeah.
And also these kinds of stories are important for a country, you know, they kind of mold the way of thinking of future generations. Stories of people who have stood up to fight corruption, to fight against crime. These are the kind of thing that if you hear these stories growing up, it forms your way of thinking, and it encourages you to become like that person. When I was a kid, I don't know how, I had found a copy of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in some magazine or something, and I stuck it up on my wall, but no one told me to do that. I didn't even know what it was. It's just because the words resonated with me, and that happened because of the stories that my parents told me of what life was like for them when they were growing up.
That's very sweet. And that's also one of the theses of my film. It is that the sense of moral and justice that most kids have is, wow, if a society could be run on those principles, it would be much better. Because what we teach our children is actually kind of beautiful things. But the thing is that the guys who are making the most money and the most wealth and controlling the societies are the people, are the kind of the bullies on the schoolyard, which is...
I mean, well, there is a fine line, because it is one thing to imbue people with a sense of victimhood, which can very rapidly turn into a kind of extremist mentality that everyone is out to get you and so on. And it is another to imbue people or to imbue children with a sense of justice. Those are two different things. There's a fine line, and you have to be careful not to cross it.
Yeah, but my feeling is just that when people are getting angry around the world right now, is that they actually do it from a sense of this is not fair. It's like the same feeling that many children have. You know, it's a very basic thing of...
Of course.
What the fuck is happening here? I mean, in Israel right now, you know, it's like when we have a deal, we have an agreement of how we should run this country, and then you try to take it away. You know, I mean, I think that's something that people are... I mean, deep inside, they want a society to be kind of fair. People should have a fair chance to do something or to develop. And when they take that away, then you have a problem. And Sarah Chase, who's in the film, I mean, one of her theses is, I mean, she was in Afghanistan for 10 years, and she said, in the end, she told NATO, hey, if you want to fight the Taliban's, you have to fight corruptions, because the corruption is bringing people in to the Taliban's. And she said the same in Nigeria. If you want to fight Boko Haram, you have to fight corruption. Because in the end, if the corruption is closing all the doors for people, well, the doors who can be open are the terrorists or the mafia or the, you know, it's like, so it makes sense.
It does a little bit. Of course, I don't want to sort of take away the agency from people who choose to murder, you know, or to pillage or plunder, or I mean, they are doing that by choice and not necessarily because they have been forced to do so.
No.
But of course, I mean, look, Afghanistan is a very complex situation, and I know so little about the country. But yes, I mean, there has to be the sort of desire to fight corruption has to come from within a people, and it has to be supported as well.
Yeah, but I mean, you can bring it down to pay taxes. You know, I don't mind paying taxes, but if the rich people are not paying taxes, why should I pay taxes? I mean, this is also a debate ongoing in many countries. So it's basically the same. And the system that we've seen here with the super rich dividing their personalities into different, with different passports, and they put their money somewhere, their property somewhere else, and their national identities in different places. This is also something that you and your mom has been looking deeply into the passport papers. There was a big leak on, so you could actually find out who bought the Maltese passports. Can you tell us about that?
Well, I mean, it's quite straightforward. Basically, there is a firm called Henley and Partners, and it is, I mean, they are sort of the pirates of the 21st century. I mean, they go from one weak state to another. They started in the Caribbean. It is very much, but perhaps not mostly, a real estate business. So they have investments in real estate projects. But they came up with this idea that they would sell the real estate along with a passport. So if you want to get the passport of a Caribbean country, or if you want to get a Maltese passport, you need to buy or rent, preferably one of the properties which they are selling or leasing. And this is how the company makes its money. Off the sale of the passport, it gets a commission on the sale of that, as well as the fees it charges from its real estate business.
It seems Henley and Partners, first they came to Malta and say, hey, if you take this legislation, you can make a lot of money. So they first proposed a legislation on visa incentives, and then they said, "But we can, and we can do the business." Wasn't like that more or less how it happened?
Yes, I mean, we also know, thanks to a leak from the company, that they had deals with SCL, Strategic Communications Laboratories, which is the parent company of Cambridge Analytica, where they would support the campaign for election of a particular party. And in return, once that party was in government, it would grant a concession to sell the country's passports to Henley and Partners. This is what it did in St. Kitts, in St. Vincent, Antigua, Malta, and so on.
Yeah, so a big story now about Henley and Partners in Singapore. They're bringing in a lot of people there right now. So that's like, because a lot of Chinese are leaving after the COVID. So it's like, it's a great business to sell visas and passports and to help the super rich, because that's basically, it's a wealth management service. In the film, we also have a former employee of SCL, Sven Hughes, and he is speaking out quite well about things that happened when he worked for them in election campaigns financed by Henley and Partners in the Caribbean. Let's listen to a clip from the film with Sven Hughes.
Here is a document that was provided to me by a Swiss private investigation team that were looking into Henley and Partners. And this essentially has mapped out some of the countries that Henley and Partner was involved with. Malta is one of the more complex networks. So what you can definitely see is that Henley and Partners have gone in, have engaged with the Prime Minister directly, have engaged with the Chief of Staff, with other senior ministers. Some of those senior ministers are red flagged here on this document because they're unwanted for fraud. They're wanted for government corruption. We've got London addresses, we've got Swiss addresses, we've got diplomatic passports, we've got Caribbean addresses, we've got all sort of London companies. So the whole purpose of this being so complicated, this network, is essentially to confuse you if you were trying to hold them to account, if you were trying to make them pay tax, if you were trying to find out how much money came in to whom. This is how difficult it is to find out that information.
You were smiling a bit here, Matthew.
Yeah, well, because he's right. I mean, that's precisely the purpose. It's this Russian doll type structure. It's designed to make it as confusing as possible. And in fact, even one of the more amusing things that I found in the Panama Papers is Henley and Partners itself trying to figure out who owns the company. I mean, they couldn't even establish that themselves, and they were emailing the lawyers at Mossack Fonseca, I mean, with questions trying to figure out who owns what, because they had simply lost track of it.
So they're creating this extremely complex creature, and then they can't figure it out themselves.
Lost track of it.
Yeah, now of course, and I think also as a journalist, this is complicated, because when you start to make proper journalism about this, it becomes so complicated so that it's hard to bring the readers on. Isn't that a challenge as a journalist to tell these stories, because they're so fucking complicated? So people start to read and then say, ah, boring. So they are winning also by this complication.
Well, I mean, yes and no, because quite often, I mean, the audience of this kind of reporting might not necessarily be the general public. I mean, my mother's website is cited in tens of official reports, police reports, financial intelligence reports. I mean, God knows, probably hundreds of compliance reports written up by banks or law firms and so on. So it is that audience which corrupt people are quite afraid of, because they are the people who can really sort of create problems.
Yeah, it's I mean, And I think also that's also with Rutger Bregman, who is in the film. He, you know, he got very famous one day when he was in Davos. He said people to the philanthropes that you have to pay taxes, taxes, taxes. He became viral with those with that quote. And then I asked him, why do you think that became so viral? And he said, because we are at this point in history now that everybody knows that also the rich should pay taxes. So it's like we are there in history now. So it's not a radical thing to say pay taxes, because we all think that they also should pay taxes. And I think a part of moving the general public there is also the work of the journalists behind Panama Papers and Paradise Papers and so on. So, and also your mother, who was a part of this. It's very important work to understand this shady world.
I mean, look, some tension between taxpayers, people and businesses, and the state is necessary, because you cannot give carte blanche to the state to do whatever, or a government to do whatever the hell it wants with the money that you're paying in taxes. There has to be some tension that the government feels that it has to justify what it is doing with your money. Otherwise, it loses the moral authority to collect it. That tension is really important. I mean, while I sort of respect the social services that you have in Nordic countries, and that comes with an obligation to pay high taxes, I would never trust the state in Malta with equivalently high taxes. And I do not believe that the state here has the moral authority to collect the taxes it collects now, let alone the kind of high taxes that you pay in Nordic countries.
No, I mean, taxes is always what you get for it, of course.
Yes, obviously. So we are not sort of advocating here for the state to have the ability or the authority to collect tax, you know, whatever it wishes to do with it. There has to be respect, you know, for this agreement that exists between the taxpayer and the state.
Yeah, and if there is no agreement, people will just be angry, of course.
Of course, and there are places like Malta where that agreement is not respected.
Yeah. I have two questions or comments coming in from our audience. First from Carl Shembri. He say, "Hi, Matthew, great to see you." That was like very short, but sweet. We like friendly people out there. Martina, who I don't have a surname, I'm asking, do you think international investigators are doing enough against people like Christian Kaelin, the passport king, Switzerland? After all, people like him help build the golden passport structure that often amounts to favoring criminals, handling partners. That should be a police investigation too.
I mean, I think journalists are doing as much as they can. I don't think that judicial and executive authorities are doing enough. I don't think police investigators, prosecutors are doing enough. Either because they can't, because they don't have the budget, or they don't have the skills, they don't have the means, or because they won't. It differs depending on the case in each country. But what I have come to realize as a result of, I mean, our own efforts to advance investigations into corruption and money laundering and organized crime, that by definition is transnational. The cases that we are investigating have affected Malta a great deal, but they involve banks, companies, money launderers in all parts of the world. Like, it's really transnational. Yeah. Like, you know, much like the companies that sell passports.
Yeah.
And I mean, state authorities, I mean, police, prosecutors, the judiciary, they do not have the tools they need to properly investigate organized crime and corruption. When the crime reaches outside of a state border, it's like you know, Roadrunner, Wile E. Coyote crashing into an invisible wall. It's really like that. They simply cannot reach outside the state borders. Or they can, but in a sort of very limp way.
Yeah. I think sometimes the understanding of corruption and the tax havens is a little bit blurred because, I mean, you see like tropical paradise, you see the palm trees, you see the yachts. It's like a luxury life. And we don't, it's a little bit hard to understand how their life or their thefts are impacting our own societies. I mean, in my previous film, Push, we talked about the global housing crisis, and the global housing crisis is also a crisis because of a lot of this money floating into real estate. So a lot of criminal money get laundered into real estate and it pushes up the prices. And 90% of all new investment in housing in the UK were coming from tax paradises. You don't even know who the new owners of these buildings are. And a lot of them are also standing empty. So that is one impact on the local society. But I mean, you talk to Malta, you can see the effect on Malta because Henley and Partners and all these guys, when they come to Malta, they say, okay, but we also have friends. We will help you to win the election, but we have friends who need some help with real estate deals, with to build a...
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, all this. And that impacts the local society.
I mean, one of the greatest frauds in the Passports for Cash scheme is that passport buyers have to have a genuine link to the EU member state of which they are becoming a citizen, in this case, Malta. The government has created this scheme, which it knows to be a fraud, where they can rent a property and the government considers that to be enough of a genuine link, even though they never lived there. Mm. Some of the buyers spend less than 12 hours in Malta total.
Yeah.
So this is not a genuine link at all. The scheme was sold to the public as a way to bring investment into the country. Now, I mean, even though Malta accepted as an electorate that the scheme is tied to real estate, not a single one of the passport buyers has made an investment in housing. Not a single one. Even though the country is in desperate need of housing, I mean, not a single passport buyer has invested in any kind of business, I mean, let alone a housing project. Yeah. It's a complete sham from start to finish.
And it also, I mean, when they still have to rent some apartment somewhere, so that I guess they're just standing empty. So it also means that the rent price for people in Malta has skyrocketed also.
I mean, as a landlord, the pattern is as sort of a landlord business model, that you buy a flat or construct a block of apartments and you rent these apartments to passport buyers. So you have a sort of ghost tenant who is paying 1,300 euros a month. That is the minimum which most of the passport buyers pay. No matter whether they're a millionaire or a billionaire, they always pay the minimum because these are sort of streetwise people, which is how they made their money in the first place. And then you also have the flat on Airbnb. So you have sort of two rental streams of income from the same property. But of course, both of these income streams exclude people who actually want to establish a permanent residence in the property.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember I was taking a taxi on Malta. In Cyprus. And the taxi driver told me that since the invasion of all the Cyprus golden passport buyers, his rent was tripled in a year. It has a severe effect on the local population also. So even if you think, oh, we're doing this business because it's good for the country, we bring in money. And this is, I mean, Leilani Farah, who is part of this podcast, She was as a UN special rapporteur in Portugal and looking into their golden passport scheme. And it's, I mean, it's majority of the money goes into real estate. And it's just, in many ways, just made life more expensive for the Portuguese, for the people living in Lisbon and Porto. And the revenues of all these investments are not really coming to the people.
Not really. I mean, they, and the way the scheme is sort of dangled before the eyes of a hungry population is that thanks to all of this investment, suddenly your country is going to turn into the next Venice or the next Paris, let's say. You're going to have all these beautiful real estate projects.
Yeah.
But because, again, the scheme attracts people who only want to satisfy the bare minimum of the requirements. The kind of property developments that we have, and also in Cyprus, I was there recently. I mean, I am sorry to say that, like Malta, most parts of the country, most urban parts of the country are absolutely hideous. Yeah. It is because of these equally hideous real estate projects that are built, constructed, I mean, to create, to sort of satisfy this market of passport buyers.
If the landlord doesn't even live in the country, I mean, why should he care about the looks of it, of the design of the property? It's absentee landlords are the worst landlords to have. We have some more questions here. Now Carl says more than hi. In Malta, we are seeing case after case of state prosecution, attorney general and police losing court cases against potential criminals without any accountability. Nobody is scrutinizing their performance. Incompetence, if that's what it is also part of corruption. Yet it seems our advocacy is not cutting through to move things at this level or even generate outrage. What can be done? So you think you work a lot, but it doesn't really pay off. Is that also your feeling, Matthew?
I mean, the game that the government and, I mean, again, which is controlled by a party that has for a long time been in league with criminal groups, the game that they're playing is one of stamina. I mean, who is exhausted first? And we have to make sure that we're the ones who are the last to be exhausted.
In your passport work, and that was really important for me when I was doing the film, and I was actually, in some way, I was trying to make a connection also with, because Malta is also in the midst, in the Mediterranean, where people are drowning at sea. And so you have immigrants from Africa drowning at your coast, and then you have...
If you survive, you get to die on a construction site, yeah.
Exactly. And then you have billionaires from Nigeria, I mean, almost the same place where people are fleeing from, flying in and buying passports. That really touches my stomach and makes me angry. It's very absurd that this is happening at the same place, you know, where...
Of course. I mean, it's something out of the Middle Ages. You think that after the Enlightenment, you know, we would be beyond this kind of, you know, blatant, piracy.
Yeah. Money can buy anything.
Exactly. I mean, you would think that we were sort of working towards a system where... our societies are based on merit or, you know, fairness, equality of opportunity and so on. But unfortunately, there are people who are always trying to send us in the opposite direction.
Yeah. And that's what I made this film, Breaking Social, because it's very much about that. And I hope I can come to Malta and show the film. I've just now been, we had a world premiere just 10 days ago in Copenhagen, CPH Doc, one of the biggest doc festivals in the planet. And then I was in Prague for the One World Film Festival, which is a human rights film festival. And I was this week and Tuesday, I was also in Brussels showing the film. But the film is now coming to festivals around the world and also later on in theaters in different countries. And I just wanted to say that We are right now in the midst of a crowdfunding campaign on Kickstarter, where we're trying to raise money so we can have an impact campaign going on. So we think that if we want to change the world, we need to change the conversation. And that is something we do together with people like you, Matthew, to change the conversation. And you're a key player in this. There is one more question coming in here. And that's, again, from Valentina Scambia. Hello, I know it's not directly connected, but could you share a little bit about taste and flair? I don't know anything, so you have to update me.
Of course. So my mom she was a kind of Renaissance woman. I mean, good at many different things, had many different interests. She studied archaeology and then diplomacy. I mean, graduated top of her class. She wrote. I mean, she always had lots of ideas and was objective as well as artistic. I mean, she had sort of both sides in her personality. And one of her businesses that allowed her to do her journalism independently, because she didn't have to depend on employment as a journalist to do that, was Taste and Flair. Originally, it was one magazine, Taste, which was about food and cooking in Malta. It featured Maltese chefs or sort of amateur cooks who were very good at what they did and very innovative, highlighted the use of kind of indigenous or local ingredients. And the magazine was a huge success. There was really nothing like it in Malta, and everyone wanted to advertise in the magazine. I mean, every sort of food-related business. And then she set up another magazine about architecture and interior design. That was another one of her interests. And you can see that at the house that she built with my dad. Eventually, the magazines merged. And after her murder, my mom's sister, Corinne, my aunt, stepped in to continue editing the magazine and to ensure that it continues to be published to this day. And that for us is a real victory. You know, the fact that Corinne and the designers and contributors keep the magazine going, and it is still, I mean, successful as a business.
Yeah. And also I think, I mean, that's me as a filmmaker. I worked with an amazing cinematographer, Janis Davila from Brazil. And I think beauty is also important. And I think when we've been doing this film, we try very hard to show the beauty also in resistance of people fighting back. You know, artists in many ways are also telling a story on how life could be. I think that was also the lightness of your mom, was that she was also had a projection of that this could be, life could be different. We could have a more beautiful world. And I think that projection of beauty is really important. We should, even if we are, I mean, you've been hardly hit, but I mean, to keep that spirit up is very important, not to become, I mean, I think also Bregman says that in the film, that cynicism, bitterness is also making you less eager to fight back. But how do you do that? How do you keep the spirit up? And because it's easy to lose it sometimes, the energy.
Of course, I mean, there are many moments of exasperation. Mm. But we're a team of people. I mean, we're sort of friends and allies, all fighting for the same thing, for the same vision. And I guess we all support each other.
Yeah.
I mean, we try to anyway.
Yeah, in the film, we also talk about the Shift News, which is a Maltese web publication, which I recommend everybody to follow also. It's a very important way of following the cases around. And what is, can you just finalize the status of your mom's murder case? because it's been ongoing for a long time, 5 years later.
The hitmen have been convicted. There is a separate case against the people who are accused of supplying the bomb that was used in the assassination. And there is also a case against the accused mastermind, Jürgen Fenech. He was a key figure in an energy deal between Malta and Azerbaijan that my mother was investigating. He was an agent who used offshore companies to pass kickbacks between SOCA, the state oil and gas company of Azerbaijan, and Maltese government officials. My mother had uncovered that he was the owner of an offshore company called 17 Black. That was one of the companies used in this sort of network to pass kickbacks between one group and another. And he is due to stand trial towards the end of this year, I imagine.
But he's still a free man?
No, he's in custody.
He's in custody. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's good.
Pre-trial.
Yeah. So, yeah, and then this the energy deal was also dragged one other country into corruption. It's also Montenegro. That's right.
It's
same of, and I've been there also meeting people, and it also created a lot of turmoil in Montenegro.
Publicly, the people involved claim to do everything out of a sense of patriotic duty. You know, I love my country. We want to reduce corruption, invest in projects. You know, we're doing this for you, the people. This power plant is a gift to the people of Malta. This wind farm is a gift to the people of Montenegro, and so on. And privately, I mean, you see very clearly that it's a load of bullshit and they're a bunch of hypocrites, and they're all figuring out how they can profit from these schemes illegally. Because profiting legally is, of course, fair.
Matthew, I think we've been talking for almost an hour, so I think this is maybe it's what we need. We have a question here from Katarina Steinfeld, and she asked, when will there be a screening in Malmo? That's where I am, in Malmo, Sweden. It will be, I think, in August. So it's where the theatrical release of the film in Sweden will be probably in August, and Germany, and maybe also around the same time. So I mean, there are more and more countries coming up. But again, if you want this film to have a life, contact us and ask for the film. We can always organize screenings. And of course, right now, please check out the Kickstarter campaign. I think there will be a link somewhere out here so you can see it. But been a pleasure to have you on the podcast, Matthew.
Likewise.
And thank you for your great work. And you are an inspiration, and as are all the investigative journalists working out there. And I hopefully my film can add something little extra to this debate also.
It really does. We're grateful for it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Matthew. And send my regards to our friends in Malta, Joanna and Caroline and others. They are happy for the time they gave us to film in Malta.
Thank you for everyone who stayed to listen.
Yeah. Take care, all of you. Bye. See you.
So, Leilani, with Matthew, we talked about the golden visas, the golden passport schemes. I know when you were a special rapporteur, you went to Portugal and you digged a little bit deeper into that story. Also, Canada has an experience of golden passports. You know, you have these incentives where if you invest some money, you can get the passport. So what are your takes on the golden passports?
Yeah, I remember when I went to Portugal, I actually was unfamiliar with this phenomenon of golden passports or golden visas, where citizenship is granted just based on money, or residency is based on the ability to pay for it. And one of the things that struck me at the time was that, in fact, it was the regional bank in Europe that was recommending such a program in the face of austerity, as a way for countries in the south of Europe in particular to raise money. I mean, like a kind of liquidity for a country. And then, of course, it was when I learned about it, it was in the midst of an ongoing now migrant crisis, refugee crisis, where people were desperate to get into a country for safety and security. And because they had no money, they couldn't avail themselves of this program. So a manifestly unfair program, and obviously allows for corrupt money to flow. That's obviously who's going to use that kind of mechanism. So, I mean, I was pressuring the government of Portugal to get rid of such a program, which they have now supposedly done
recently. They have changed it a bit. They've altered it.
They
still have it, but they are not allowing any more investment into Lisbon and Porto and some other place.
Okay. So, I thought I heard that they were getting rid of it entirely, but maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah. But Cyprus got rid of it. Right. For example, and that was actually Al Jazeera who...
That's right, they did that big expose, Al Jazeera. Yeah. And I remember when you went with Push the Film to Cyprus, people were really talking about this golden visa problem.
Yeah, and because people were bribing ministers, and they also got people into the country with fake identities.
But it goes directly to what you talk about in Breaking Social, right? And it's, of course, raised there. But the idea of a country and its citizenship being an asset. Anything national is an asset now. They sell it. They're selling the pieces of the country as an asset, residency as an asset. I mean, we've come too far, shall we say.
Yeah, that's exactly. And now, dear audience of this Pushback Talks, if you would like to see the film before anyone else, you can go in and support the Kickstarter campaign. Two ways: you can get a link for yourself. Even better for us, if you have enough money to buy a special screening for a bigger group. If you're an NGO, if you're a company who want to do something for at your workplace, you can go in and pre-buy a screening to have this happening long before the films meets the audiences around the world. So have a look at kickstarter.com and look for Breaking Social. And also a link, we will post it here in the podcast. Leilani, you know, this is your week off, but you're still working, it seems.
Yes, always working, unfortunately. Yeah. No, I will take some time.
Yeah, okay. So then I wish you a happy Easter. Do you eat a lot of eggs in Canada also, or what is the story?
Chocolate eggs.
Chocolate eggs. Yeah, yeah. Here it's eggs, and then it's herring.
Herring, of course.
Yeah.
We associate herring with the Swedes, for sure.
Yeah. So we'll see. We'll see. And of course, we had some lamb also. That's good.
Right, right.
So I wish you all the best, and let's connect soon, because we have some interesting stuff coming up soon, don't we, in new episodes. So
I think so.
Please follow the... Follow Pushback Talks.
Yeah, we're going to go to a couple of different countries, I think, aren't we?
Yeah.
Maybe. See what's going on. Check out what's going on outside of Europe and Canada.
That's also important. So thank you, my dear. And let's talk soon again.
Thanks, Frederick. Happy Easter.
Same to you, Leilani.
Pushback Talks is produced by WG Film. To support the podcast, become a patron by going to patreon.com/pushbacktalks or follow us on social media at make_the_shift and push_the_film.